Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Krishna. Krishna in Vrindavan. Krishna in Vrindavan as a cowherd boy. Encountering the Agasura demon. Canto 10, chapter 12. We'll start with text 19. So Agasura showed up. The boys were playing. Sukadeva Goswami is describing their good fortune to be playing with the absolute truth. And in the course of the day, around 11 o'clock in the morning, there was this huge serpent, 8 miles long, really big, and they were trying to figure out what it was. Is it something created by Krishna just for us to play with, made of stone, or maybe it's actual a creature intending to kill us, and maybe this and maybe that. The boys said, "Dear friends, is this creature dead? Or is it actually a living python with its mouth spread wide just to swallow us all? Kindly clear up this doubt." Prabhupada's purport. The friends began to discuss among themselves the reality of the wonderful creature laying there before them. Was it dead? Or was it actually a living python trying to swallow them? Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur writes, some called out to the chief boys to confirm their thoughts. Is this some type of immovable living entity? Kuta, K-U-T-A, means a peak, indicating some large animal. Is it some peaceful tiger or other big animal who has his mouth open as if to devour us? Jiva Goswami writes, please tell us whether this is some immobile creature, sattva kutam, in front of us, whose front part is in the form of a snake's mouth gaping in order to devour us. Text 20. Thereafter they decided, dear friends, this is certainly an animal sitting here to swallow us all. Its upper lip resembles a cloud reddened by the sunshine, and its lower lip resembles the reddish shadows of a cloud. And Vishwanath writes in his commentary, one boy agreed with him. The cloud reddened by the sun seems to be his upper lip. And its reflection reddening the ground seems to be his lower lip. Hanu here means lip or jaw. So you know the meaning of Hanuman's name? Huh? And Hanu means jaw. Good. Jiva Goswami. Others said, you speak the truth. A cloud lit by the morning sun is like a snake's upper lip, the mountain slope made red by the reflection from the cloud is like its lower lip. Some boys asked the question in the previous verse. Other boys answer in four verses, agreeing with them. You speak the truth, satyam. It is red with the sunlight. This indicates, listen to this, this indicates that the boys were going west because it's still morning and there's the reflection, so it's going west because the sun is in the east and the demon was facing east. The boys were going west and the demon was facing east. Thus, the morning light lit up the snake. Text 21. On the left and on the right, the two depressions resembling mountain caves are the corners of its mouth, and the high mountain peaks are its teeth. So this guy is really big. Vishwanath writes, look here, these two caves appear to be like the front part of a mouth. And these mountains, pointing with his forefinger, appear like a serpent's teeth. Jiva Goswami, short. Those groups of high mountain peaks, which are right in front of us, compete with a snake's teeth. Text 22. In length, remember it's 8 miles long, 8 miles long, 8 miles long. That's big. And breadth, in length and breadth, the animal's tongue resembles a broad traffic way. And inside of its mouth is very, very dark, like the cave of a mountain, the cave in a mountain. Vishwanath writes, the wide road is like a tongue. The darkness between the mountain peaks is like the opening of his mouth. Jiva Goswami writes, the long, wide, astrita road resembles a tongue. The shadows of the cave are compared to the inside of a snake's mouth because both were black. Sanatan Goswami, listen to this. In Vrindavan, because of unlimited cows wandering about, it appeared there was a wide road naturally everywhere. And one more commentary. The animal's tongue, rasana, resembles a wide astrita ayam, a wide road. Inside of its mouth is a very dark mountain cave, like a mountain cave. And the next 23 text, the hot fiery wind is the breath coming out of its mouth, which is giving off a bad smell of burning flesh because of all the dead bodies he has eaten. Smelly. Vishwanath writes, the smell of animals burned in the forest fire seems to be like the smell of flesh digesting in a snake's stomach. And Jiva Goswami, short, they speak in astonishment. Look, the hot wind resembles a snake's breathing. Text 24. Then the boy said, has this living creature come to swallow us? If he does so, he will immediately be killed like Bakasura without delay. Thus, they looked at the beautiful face of Krishna, the enemy of Bakasura, and, laughing loudly and clapping their hands, they entered the mouth of the python. Prabhupada's purport. After talking about the terrible animal this way and that way, they decided to enter the demon's mouth. They had full faith in Krishna, because they had experienced how Krishna had saved them from the mouth of Bakasura. Now, here was another asura, Agasura. Therefore, they wanted to enjoy the sport of entering the demon's mouth and being saved by Krishna, the enemy of Bakasura. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur writes, together they spoke with a little fear, this thing, if it is really a snake and we enter his mouth, will he swallow us up? Someone then answered to calm them down, if it is so, then in an instant, kshanena, he will be killed as Baka was killed by Krishna, anena. Saying this, he smiled while looking at Krishna, who was standing some distance away. Krishna is within our glance, so what have we to worry? Getting this answer, they all began to laugh loudly and said, friends, we must find out what is in that mouth. Then they entered the mouth out of boyish curiosity. They ran in, clapping their hands to show their fearlessness and courage, or to dismiss the snake. The calves, also raising their tails, ran after them inside the snake's mouth. And Jiva Goswami's commentary says, saying this, they laughed loudly on making analogies with the snake. They looked at Krishna's face and laughed loudly to show that what they said was a joke, saying, you should be careful here, to show courage and pride, along with fearlessness, as if driving away a snake. They ran forward. Now, reference to this verse, this is 10:12:24, is being made in a later chapter, which is chapter 15. And the chapter 15 is another incident, the Dinakasura incident. So chapter 15 verse reads, once some of the cowherd boys, including Sridham, the very close friend of Balaram and Krishna, with Subal, Stoka Krishna, and others, lovingly spoke the following words. And the purport is, this is the first day that they graduated from taking care of calves to taking care of cows. So now Krishna's five. He graduated. The first day's herding cows is described as typical of other days, to show some of the powers that Krishna manifested while herding the cows to please his dear friends, a story is related. Balaram's name is mentioned before Krishna's because he was the most prominent in fighting. Subal and others were also friends. Sridham is mentioned first amongst the other friends, because he was the chief friend in Vraja. Another boy was called Stoka Krishna. He was given this four-syllable name because it would have been improper to call him Krishna. His form was similar to Krishna's, and thus giving a similar name, his father thought that the name would produce affection for Krishna. The boys spoke out of love for a dear friend, not for obtaining tala fruit, and not for getting the demon killed. The nature of prema is sometimes expressed as a request for a desired object. They made the request with the desire that Balaram and Krishna could eat out of affection as friends. Friend arises because of great similarity in which each has knowledge of the other's abilities. And then comes this reference to text 24. Quote, has this living creature come to swallow us if we enter it? If he does, he will immediately be killed like Bakasura by Krishna without delay. Thus, the boys speak in the next verse with knowledge of Balaram's powers. This is now Dhenukasura. The love indicated here is natural friendship mixed with virya rasa. That's a secondary rasa. Similar to Arjuna requesting Krishna's help while fighting. And the last section for this evening, I think, is Jiva Goswami's comment or his commentary from Priti Sandarbha. And in Priti Sandarbha, he's describing features of rasa. So he's discussing anubhava. And the anubhava that's inappropriate is quoted here. Oh, Rama, Rama, mighty armed one, Krishna, destroyer of the miscreants, not far from here is a very great forest filled with rows of palm trees. Same chapter 15, Dhenukasura. There is an abhasa of Sakya. Abhasa means shadow or reflection of Sakya, the friendship. So there is an abhasa of Sakya by unsuitably urging their friend to go to a fearful place. Actually, however, telling Krishna and Balaram to do this is not unsuitable, since they know Krishna has prowess, similar to themselves, having similar vira natures. They do this to nourish priti for him. And Arjuna's actions are similar. It's quoting a verse from chapter 58. Chapter 58 is, it comes just after the Pandavas complete their exile and they return to Indraprastha, and Krishna goes to visit them in Indraprastha. And one of the things that happens, whether in Indraprastha, Krishna and Arjuna go hunting in the forest together. So that's the scene. Quote, it's 58, verse number 14. Arjuna went to sport with Krishna in a large forest filled with fierce animals. So, virya, their prowess, their strength is being demonstrated. No fear of wild animals. In fact, they're going sporting in that place. Arjuna went out of prema, knowing Krishna's powers, to destroy huge beasts doing destructive activities. The cowherds express their knowledge of Krishna's power in the following way, and this is the final verse for this morning, and it's our verse 24. And tomorrow we'll continue with verse 24 because there's a lot more. So the translation of text 24, has this living creature come to swallow us if we enter it? If he does, he will immediately be killed like Bakasura by Krishna without delay. The emphasis in this little section is, this is one of the features of the friendship rasa, five primary rasas, and one of the features of friendship is recognizing the traits and qualities and strengths of one another, as friends will know about one another. And it's not putting Krishna at risk. It's having a pastime, having the happiness of watching Krishna do it again. using his strength and protecting them in case there is some difficulty. So they're fully sheltered in Krishna with a sense of playfulness. Meaning that there's, there's six limbs or angas of surrender. Accepting things favorable, rejecting things unfavorable to bhakti. The last one is Atmanivedana, full dedication of body, mind, and self to Krishna. And there's three others. 3 + 3 = 6. What are the three others? Krishna is my maintainer. He is my protector. Huh? Humility. Danya. So, it seemed foolish. I mean, they figured it out, and they're going anyways. Because the two motives or reasons why they would do something so foolish. They're just curious to like what's in there. The curiosity of a child. And the second reason given is they want to experience the pastime of Krishna protecting them. Now, why put Krishna to trouble? To protect you. That's not something that we should do. But if you're a cowherd boy in Braja, no problem. Just like, you know, the other, it's in chapter 15, Dainuka. Bhaktivinoda Thakur describes his nature was envious. Because he can't reach the tall fruits, no one should reach the tall fruits. Then no one comes into this forest. And when somebody comes into the forest to get tall fruits, oh, I'm going to kill them. It's one of the demoniac propensities, or one of the natures that obstacles on our spiritual lives that we need to guard against and be protected from such tendency of ass-like envy, enviousness. I'm pausing because I made the mistake before coming over here of looking at the news and all this blah, blah, blah of, you know, bashing Donald Trump and Donald Trump bashing the people that bash Donald Trump. It's like Dainuka against Dainuka. Krishna, help us. So, on the path of bhakti, there's obstacles. And if you're a cowherd boy, there's obstacles. But, they enjoy seeing Krishna's display of strength. It's not so much, like, you know, seeing him exhibit his divinity. It's just, you know, Krishna's wonderful. That's the extent of their appreciation. He says, you know, we're always protected. And they don't mind. And they don't have fear. One of the arguments that comes in chapter 37, which we're discussing in the morning, that Narada is giving to Krishna is outside of Vrindavan, they have fear. Now inside Vrindavan, the fear is for the safety of Krishna. It's not so much for their safety. It's the safety of Krishna. primarily. That's their concern. That's, you know, especially in the parental rasa. And they're not looking to his divinity, they're looking to protect Krishna. That's what parents do. Loving parents. And we heard yesterday that, I find it really interesting, so I'm commenting on it again. Lila Shakti or Yoga Maya made the arrangement for Agasura to come. And one of the reasons, there's the demigods, they're in apprehension about this terrible demon, and they want to see this terrible demon killed. But the other was to interrupt their playing activities so the boys could have lunch. Very practical. Here's the lunch bell, and the lunch bell is here's a big demon. Okay, Krishna, deal with the big demon so we can stop and have lunch. The indication, in other words, it comes again and again. When boys are having fun playing, even, you know, worldly kinds of dynamics, they're just really happy to be playing and play and play and play, and they can just play all day. And for parents, they're concerned about, you know, it's time to have your meal, and it's time to take your bath, and it's time for this and time to that. They don't have a sense of time. They just have a sense of playing. So what to speak of the transcendental happiness? It's not just the cowherd boys, Krishna too. We discussed this a little bit yesterday from the earlier stages before they were herding calves. Then it comes later also when they're herding cows. But they're really having a good time. And Krishna just forgets himself. And that's one of the reasons why Narada comes and has to say Krishna's name twice, because he's so absorbed in his loving exchanges with the resident of Vrindavan. And a big part of every day, he's with the cowherd boys. A big part of every night is with the gopis. And some part of the day he's with mother and father or the elders. So and all the rasas are being fulfilled. But for Krishna's happiness is so full, he forgets himself. So Yogamaya arranges, okay, yeah, we have to move on to the next Lila Krishna. So Yogamaya arranges. It's not like without Krishna's consent, who can understand the omniscience of anyone? How can understand the omniscience of Krishna in Vrindavan? So how does it work? Krishna's in Vrindavan enjoying so much, he won't stop for lunch. Then what to speak of our prayers to Krishna when we're here struggling with material nature? Is Krishna going to pay attention? He's having a blast with the cowherd boys. Is he going to hear, or how does the omniscience of Krishna work? Well, he's omniscient. It doesn't work like we might think. How do you measure omniscience? How do you measure anything that's immeasurable? And to say, if he does it through his expansion as Paramatma, then that makes it sound like Krishna is not omniscient. Paramatma's got some portion of omniscience, but Krishna isn't occupied like Paramatma is occupied with every last little detail of material nature, guna and karma, the whole thing. We can't limit the unlimited. We can't measure the immeasurable. How? By omnipotence, that's how. By omniscience, that's how. And it's his nature. It's really mind expanding when you, start to think about some things and the details of some things. How do all the puzzle pieces fit together? And to some degree we can contemplate and analyze and see this puzzle piece fits together with that part of the puzzle and that puzzle piece over there. Just a little, it's related, but without going into so much detail, our whole picture of the structure of the universe from science is so different from the picture of Vedic cosmology. This is just a for example. You know what precession is? Precession. You know what that is? You know, have you ever played with a top? Okay. So when the top is spinning, there's the axis, but it kind of goes like that, right? You may be able to get it to just go up and down vertical, but if it's anything other than vertical, it does this. The axis goes around. So according to modern astronomy, the axis of the Earth, everybody knows, you learned it in eighth grade science, it's tilted at 23.5 degrees, something like that. And so that the pole is pointed towards the pole star, and it moves around, and it, you know, the whole sky moves around. We can observe it, or modern astronomers with their telescopes can observe it, or there's computer systems now that you can watch it by computer technology, if you're interested. There's a program, and you can download it. It's free. You can watch the whole thing. Anyway, so precession is the movement of the axis of the Earth, and it's supposed to point towards the North Star, but according to modern astronomy, every 25,800 years, nearly 26,000 years, the place that the pole points to shifts. So what we say, there's a conflict. And we say all the planets are moving around the pole star, and it doesn't change every 25,800 years. But the Vedic picture describes very differently. It doesn't describe the Earth spinning at the tilt of 23.5 degrees. The model is very different. And it's described in different language without going into what the Vedic language is, because it would take too long. And I don't really fully understand it either. But in short, the pole star doesn't change. It's the pole star is the pole star is the pole star. And the planets are moving around the pole star. It doesn't matter, you know, the tilt of the axis of the Earth and the spinning of the Earth and the whole thing. It's a paradigm shift. You know, and especially in modern days, you know, it's as science has evolved to, you know, more sophisticated and more precise measurements and so forth and so on. The model is a very different model. It's a very different model. So how are we to look at things when the model that you've grown up, you know, the mind is carrying conceptions? We know that from Bhagavad Gita, and we know it from our practical experience. Like, you know, here's these two stuffed animals on the back of the couch. And so, if I didn't know what a puppy dog looked like, I would look at that and go, what's that? But because I have some idea that a dog that has flappy ears and so forth and so on, when I can compute because of some conception that's within the mind. Supposing you see something that doesn't match a conception what's in the mind, or supposing the conception that you have within your mind is a mistaken conception, like the rope and snake example, or anything else. The perception becomes reality, but it's not necessarily reality. Perception can be mistaken because of the senses and the mind. And that's what we're dealing with. In everyday life, we're to speak of, you know, what's the spiritual world like? Transcendence. If it doesn't match the senses in the mind, we have a problem processing it. It bounces, or it just kind of hangs in the air somewhere. We're scratching our head saying, but what to speak of something that's transcendental, even something that's worldly, that the whole picture of how the world works, the Vedic picture is very different. It can predict events very precisely. It can measure distances of celestial bodies very precisely without the use of Hubble telescopes. And refining and refining and refining and refining of the calculations of things. It would be really good if from childhood we just went to a gurukul and learned the Vedic model of everything. And not just, you know, learned it, but deeply ingested it, and then how we experience the world is the Vedic experience of the world. But that's not the case. The case is we have the modern, whatever you want to call it, scientific picture of the world, of everything, sociology and governance and you name it. You know, what causes the sun to rise and set? And how do you calculate things? Anyway, and what are the senses? There's so many. The Vedic picture is so different. There's an ear, that organ, and then the Vedic picture is there's the subtle sense of hearing. And the Vedic picture is there's a demigod that's in charge of that subtle sense of hearing that works through the sense organ. And then there's the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vasudev, who empowers the demigods to do what the demigods do, to control the power of sense that works through the sense organ that perceives as the sense object. And then ultimately Krishna is the source of that, who empowers the whole thing. Our worship goes to that source of all things, with an understanding of how all things are happening. And we don't take anything for granted because it doesn't happen mechanically or by chemical evolution or some other way that it inexplicably happens. It's a whole other picture of who we are and how we live, and how we interact with the world around us and each other, and it's a whole worldview. And it's very different. So it's challenging to like re-script. I imagine it's really challenging for someone your son's age going to school and learning that and then hearing this and you're in between two worlds. It's challenging for us who have already bought into the other and now we're hearing that something else. One of the challenges of the Temple of Vedic Planetarium, one of the many challenges, is what do the Vedas say? And then another challenge, because it's mysterious. The language is mysterious. Then another challenge is the worldly people that don't have a clue about the Vedic model. And if they ask this and that, how will it be supported? Just, well, this is what the Vedas say, and we're just depicting what the Vedas say. But, you know, then how do you deal with, and so, and that's with things that are empiric or, you know, measurable, because there are things that are unmeasurable. And that's one of the topics that come up in the course, like your question this morning about eternal time taking events that are of eternal time taking place in the events in the realm where it's not eternal time. How do the two fit together? It's really mind-expanding, mind-boggling. And here we are reading, you know, Agasura. He's lying in the road and 8-mile-long serpent with his jaws, upper jaws up in the clouds and huge thing with the desire to kill Krishna. And the cowherd boy appearing fearless. And clapping their hands and laughing as they, you know, to say, you know, na 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 na, you know, like we have nothing to fear. Because Krishna is near. They looked and he was observing. Of course he's omniscient anyways. So, it's nice to have your senses challenged, your mind and senses challenged. It's nice. So we'll continue tomorrow hearing what happens after they enter the mouth of the Agasura demon. Let's see if there's some discussion.
Thank you so much, Maharaj. I have three questions. One is about Agasura. So, I mean, he knows that his brother and sister were killed.
Yeah.
But still he said he wanted to kill Krishna. So, I mean, it looks like it's like foolish. Because
he's very foolish.
Krishna was so small and like a baby, he killed his sister. And in our case also, we try to, take a lot of false shelters. So sometimes they don't, we know that they don't work, but still again we do, I do that. So, it's like that same kind of mentality, but.
Yeah. So. It's a reflection that you're sharing, yeah.
So, yeah, I was just thinking, how do we not have that kind of mentality,
Well, how do we break out of illusion? Illusory sense of false shelter. The false shelter is an illusion. It's a fundamental dimension or aspect of illusion. And we had heard by the Lord's internal potency, he can dismiss illusion. Bhakti has the power to dismiss illusion. And even that where the illusion takes shelter is in the mind. That illusory conception. Bhakti has the power. So, that's the answer. Otherwise you're just shifting it, like the example of, you know, you're carrying a weight on your left shoulder and just shift it to your right shoulder. You're carrying the weight. The weight of illusion, if it looks like this or it looks like that, it's illusion. So, how to dismiss illusion? The false shelters that are an essential part of illusion. Well, so part of it is to see the bucket has no holes, and then you look at another model, a bucket doesn't have holes. That's empiric, or that's by cultivation of knowledge, or, you know, use of our reasoning faculty. But ultimately, that's infallible, because we're conditioned, we go over to the bucket with holes in it. Because of the reasons that we're in illusion. We have an enmity toward Krishna and a desire to be separate enjoyers, and so we buy into illusion. You have to buy into illusion in order to live that type of a life. So then, the bucket has holes in it, let's look at another model that doesn't have holes in it. And you test it out. And wow, it doesn't have holes in it. So it's sadhana bhakti is the means to get on the other side of those false shelters. Starting with hearing and chanting. We're weak. So we're not getting the full strength and full benefit of that hearing and chanting, but it's the right procedure.
Thank you, Maharaj. My second question is about the Gopa friends. They are not worried about, they are getting into trouble, or, they are thinking that Krishna is going to save them. But the elderly, elderly Gopas and Gopis, they are worried about Krishna's, safety. So, it's like fear is, even for children also, it's a fear. But they are not so much worried about it.
Yes. There's variety amongst them.
There is a lot of trust on Krishna, but still that fear is there. So I was just thinking how they're getting into that and then...
Some had fear, some had no fear. And some were in the middle. There's the spectrum of relationships with Krishna, even amongst the cowherd boys. So what to speak of us? There's a spectrum of relationships. And it's all hanging on their relationship. But part of the relationship, these are not like practitioners, or these are perfected. So the relationships are for the pleasure of Krishna relationships. So Krishna feels protective towards some and different way of protecting towards others and so forth. Same as with the gopis. Same as with the elders. The variety of relationship is the whole thing.
My last question, Maharaj, regarding the modern scientists. There are many things that they are able to get it.
Yes.
So which are like almost like matching with what Vedas say.
Yeah.
But still they don't accept, the bigger picture.
Yeah.
Reasoning, or what is that they say about the things that match, at least, not the things that they are not able to prove so far? They will deny that it's not true, maybe. But whatever they're able to find out so far, they are matching with I mean, to large extent, to, I mean, that, like a distance between sun and earth planet and all. So they're able to at least to, I mean, Vedas say those, I mean, Vedic astronomy talk about those things, and they're able to at least match those numbers. I mean, what they say about those things?
I'm not sure what your question is. As they're getting closer and closer to the actual numbers that are found in the Vedas, what's your question?
What they say about
the unknown things?
What is written in the Vedas? Because whatever they're able to find, how...
Well, I don't know what they... I imagine there's a variety of things they say. You know, it's just garbage. They don't even want to look at it. Some may want to look at it and say, that's interesting, but the model is wrong. I mean, they probably have a lot of different things to say. I'm just guessing. They'll find something that seems empirically wrong, and they'll focus on the empirically wrong and want to dismiss the whole thing. That's my guess. It's how academic people do. You find a mistake, what they think is a mistake or a contradiction or something, and if you find one, then the whole thing is just trashed. Or it gives it a bad name. I mean, just for starters, the Vedic model is earth-centered. And that's like archaic. That went out, as far as the scientists is concerned, eons ago. I mean, primitive people may have thought like that. But intelligent people don't think like that. Now, there may be some broad-minded persons that say, well, that's interesting. Tell me more about it. Okay, it's interesting. It's just relative motion. Okay. And you have the point of observation, or you have the way that it really is, as far as they're concerned. It's, you know, sun-centered. And, either it's a different way of looking at the same thing, but really it's sun-centered. You're just making your observations. So there's probably all over the place. Some may be genuinely interested in truth, but it's not to say... It's, you know, step back from all of that. Scientists have gotten some things right. We don't just, science is trash and trash it. I mean, obviously they got some things right. But the fundamental that's behind even those things that they have right, it's atheistic. That's the problem. And there are, you know, the big picture they'll never get because of, they don't have the center. And, you know, really brilliant people. Krishna gives intelligence to mistaken people too. And they can go on and on and on about their mistaken idea. And it sounds really like, you know, the person knows their stuff. And they go on to the next thing and to the next thing and the next thing, and they all have it all, they have the whole, at least they seem to have a lot of confidence about how the whole thing fits together. And there's this question yet to be discovered, but the whole thing fits together.
And the reason I was asking was because something is given already, and something is given in the Vedic astronomy already.
Yeah.
Is available, and with odd struggle they were able to get something. And when something is matching with the whatever is already there,
some things are matching.
Yeah. Why not to explore what is there in Vedic astronomy? And
again, it's the same answer. There may be some that are interested. The open-minded, a true seeker of truth. Seeker of, you know, reality. And so they're interested in gaining whatever they can from over there to get closer to reality. Okay. Yeah.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. My question is, so one of the closest friends of Narottam Das Thakur was Ramachandra Kaviraj.
Yeah.
That two Brahmana boy story, like the worshippers of Kali, like that story. So I, at the end of that story, one of those boys took initiation from Narottam Das Thakur.
Yeah.
And the other one took from Ramachandra Kaviraj. But then Ramachandra Kaviraj's like guru was Srinivasacharya.
Yeah.
But in the Ocean of Mercy, Prabhupada said that like after the guru's demise, then the disciple is allowed to initiate.
Yes.
But like I know that Srinivasacharya was still there on this earth.
Yes.
So like is there some misunderstanding?
Very nice question. There's a number of examples like this that you just gave, and say two things. When the spiritual master gives the order to a disciple to initiate, then the disciple has the authority to initiate, and without that order of the spiritual master, the authority isn't there. Without the instruction of the spiritual master, the authority is not there. So, in our disciplic succession, prior to Bhakti Siddhanta, there are examples, there's a number of examples, like the one you just mentioned. From Bhakti Siddhanta's time and during Prabhupada's time, they were very firm about the other part of what you said, Prabhupada said. In the presence of the spiritual master, one doesn't initiate. But going back in time, there are a number of examples where even in the presence of the Diksha Guru, a disciple of Diksha Guru was instructed by Diksha Guru to initiate. And they did. Under the order of the spiritual master to initiate. So the standard prior to Bhakti Siddhanta was a little different than from Bhakti Siddhanta's time going forward in time. So that's why it happened. The order of the spiritual master. The same etiquette was not in place under the order of the spiritual master. Okay?
Hare Krishna Guru Maharaj. My question is not related with this evening.
Okay.
I have the question like, why Balram supported so much to Duryodhana? As he is the first expansion of Krishna only, but in Mahabharata, why Balram always supported or partial to Duryodhana?
It's a puzzle. And one answer to the puzzle is like, why did Radharani talk back to Krishna? Because it was pleasing to Krishna. She didn't have anything other than Krishna's pleasure in her heart. And sometimes she would take a contrary position. And that was very pleasing to Krishna. Now she may not have been consciously thinking, I'll take this contrary position because it's pleasing to Krishna. She may have been in one of Jiva Goswami's books, I forget the title, Madhava Mahotsav. She is bewildered herself. Why do I take this position? Because it's the influence of Yogamaya for Krishna's pleasure. She takes the position she takes. Because there's nothing else in her heart but the pleasure of Krishna. And Krishna enjoys that. The contrary, the anger, Man, Leela, Krishna likes. You know, sometimes he cries when Krishna likes. Krishna likes when Mother Jasoda reprimands him. Now, most children that I know, they don't like being reprimanded. But Krishna likes. And so he does things so Mother Jasoda will reprimand him. He does naughty things. It's not like, anyway, it's yoga maya once again. So similarly, Balaram sometimes would show, not always, but sometimes would show partiality towards Duryodhana and others. You know, there was a partiality towards Rukmi. And then later he smashed him. But he would take a position contrary to Krishna's interest in a yogamaya manner, because in Balaram's mood is nothing but service. Nothing but service. In all the five rasas, nothing but service. So why would, if it's service, then why would he do something that's contrary? Because it was enjoyable for Krishna. It was enjoyable for Krishna to arrange the intrigue of arranging for Subhadra to be married to Arjuna. Even he provided his own chariot and horses. It was just part of the Krishna using his cleverness, which he enjoyed doing, to work around the plan that his brother had for Duryodhana to become Subhadra. So it was, you know, it's not apparent. It's hidden or mysterious. But it's only this yogamaya influencing Balaram to do like that. Because we move in a straight line. And love doesn't go in a straight line. It's said like that by our acharyas. The love moves like a snake. From point A to point B, it goes like this. So if it's Krishna's pleasure, and so he sometimes does things that look otherwise. But there's only one thing.
I have one more question. I read the Acharya's book with my son. So for each and Acharya, after there is a Manjari name, I mean, but at the end, Prabhupada, he don't have any Manjari name. So I think you gave this answer before, but I think I forget. Some devotee asked before also. But
so
I just,
the question is, which rasa was Srila Prabhupada in? That's your question?
Yeah.
He didn't disclose it.
Mm-hmm.
And none of us have the adhikar or qualification to say. So it remains unknown. Some say this, some say that, some say the other thing. And I don't, when I hear that kind of conversation, I become a little impatient. Because who has the qualification to speculate on something like that? Or to say that they know because of this and that? I'm sorry. We don't have the adhikar to determine. Prabhupada didn't disclose it, and so be it. I mean, I'm disposed towards all of our acharyas have some manjari position. So I can't imagine Prabhupada being the exception to that standard or rule. You know, that's the comfort zone for me. But, what is it specifically? I don't know. Or it's because some people say some other things. You know, I don't go much further than what I just said. And when there's a self-effulgent acharya and heat that reveals, then we can know. And none of us have that capacity.
This question is from Pratibahu Prabhu. It is said that we can pray to Narsingadev, and Narsingadev is also called as Dr. Narsingadev for miseries. On the other hand, you mentioned, why should we disturb Krishna for such things or material things? So what should be our mood of prayer to benefit someone going through miseries?
Well, so much depends upon your level of, each of our levels of Krishna consciousness. And to pray to Krishna for the well-being of someone going through some difficulty, that's fine. And Lord Narsingadev is a common one that people go to. So go to him.
This question is from Visalaksha Prabhu. How to respond and remain fixed to act on the platform of non-enviousness towards others, even after acts from the other side?
Well, the even if has nothing to do with it. Meaning, two wrongs don't make a right. So if someone is doing something wrong, then I should do something wrong. Two wrongs don't make a right. So your decision about overcoming contaminations of heart has nothing to do with if another entity or 500 other entities have that shortcoming. It's, you know, your business is your business and their business is their business. So how to overcome envy in the heart? It's the antidote is love. Because envy is just the deterioration of our natural condition of love. So we move towards the love side and the envy side will diminish.
This question is from Sanchari Mataji from Houston. Illusion is embedded so deeply in our mind, and the practice of devotional service takes us to the platform of acting from intelligence rather than being controlled by the mind.
Yeah.
From my understanding, devotional service itself brings the mind we have now fully into its spiritual nature. What does that turning point look like? Is it like a aha moment or something that happens so subtly one doesn't even notice it occurring?
Well, it's not one thing only. The common explanation that Srila Prabhupada has given and common experience is likened to the rising of the sun in the morning. It's gradual. So that's the standard or common. Now, it may also be that some sudden shift or aha moment kind of thing can happen where there's a breakthrough. Common experience is when that aha moment happens, it gets covered over again. Common. You know, it may be that it doesn't get covered over again. So it's not like a fixed rule, but the common a transformation is gradual.
This question is from Rupa Vinod Mataji. It is said that having a family member like Maharaj Parikshit, who is a self-realized soul, hundreds of family generations are benefited and are liberated. When we take shelter of a spiritual master, since we come under the disciplic succession and the same family, Achyuta Gotra, will we be benefited in a similar way?
Not identical. I similar. Because when the first example is speaking about bodily relation, and the second example is speaking about spiritual relation. So when there's bodily relation, those who are bodily connected karmically, that's how it brings us together, is karma. The karmic connection means benefit goes to that family member, the biological family member, or the descendant, or ancestry, or something like that. But your question is specifically to the Achyuta Gotra. It's similar but different. We're getting a connection through initiation with the disciplic succession. And those disciplic succession people, personalities, they're ready to bestow benedictions upon the Achyuta Gotra members. So it's there is a slight similarity or a hint of similarity, but it's fundamentally different.
This question is from Rajeshwari Pranamataji from St. Louis. In this pastime, Krishna's cowherd boyfriends took risk. They knew Agasura was a demon, but they still went in. Even in case of Rajavasis, especially gopis, took risk to please Krishna or to be with Krishna out of their intense love for Krishna and out of their intense faith. In our case, sometimes we need to take risk to do devotional service and please Krishna. How to understand and apply that risk-taking in devotional service to please Krishna?
Great question. A friend of mine has shared with me many times he wants to write a book before he departs the world, describing Prabhupada as the entrepreneur in that, you know, the sense of the risk-taking person, because entrepreneurs take risks. And Prabhupada was not a material entrepreneur. He took enormous risks for his spiritual master. So, how do we understand the risk-taking exercise seems to be the question. How to apply it. know your strengths and your limitations, and don't overextend beyond your strength. At the same time, your strengths, limited though they may be, there's some confidence in risk-taking in the form of empowerment. Let's just say book distribution. Many of us, myself included, found book distribution difficult because we're not really salespeople. Some people are salespeople and it just comes natural for them. But so it's a risk to go out into the public where, you know what's going to happen. People aren't going to say, oh, I was just woke up this morning thinking maybe I'll meet somebody who'll give me a Bhagavad Gita and then here you are. You know, that does happen. They're looking for Krishna and you bring Krishna and they're very thankful. But there's risks involved in book distribution, the risks involved in execution of devotional service. If you know something that is pleasing to Guru and Krishna, disciplic succession and Krishna, then that's a worthy direction to move in, to take risk. And then, you know your own strength and your own capacity. Prabhupada commented, on the one hand, he commented to the devotees, Satsrup Maharaj shared this, that your Western disciples, you would not have been able to survive what I had to undergo. Because there were there were challenges and weather and so forth and so on. But his capacity was huge. Now, his capacity, and doesn't, our capacity doesn't match his capacity, so we should be risk-taking in practical application question part. We should be risk-taking knowing we don't have, that's not our capacity to do all of what he did or, you know, certain portions of what he did. Still, we, you know, we know that we have his example, we have the scriptures to go by, and we move in that direction, and capacity, common experiences, capacity increases, and then you can take greater risk. But be very cautious when you're taking risk.
So this question is from Amara Mataji. Two part question. One, is there any difference between spiritual and transcendental? And the second part is there any connection between presence of time and duality in this material world?
So this, is there a difference? There's just nomenclature. And, you know, so language, there's each word has carries a certain meaning or purpose. So transcendental, commonly the import or implication of it is beyond the influence of material or beyond the modes and beyond karma, beyond guna and karma. Transcendental carries that meaning. And spiritual is from the other side. It's like, it's of Krishna, Krishna connected. So they both indicate the same realm or region, but the connotation is somewhat different. And then the second question was?
Second question was, is there any connection between presence of time and duality in this material world?
Yeah. Time is behind everything. Time and Krishna are the same. And the connection is from Krishna comes everything. And part of everything is this realm of duality. So the connection is cause and effect. Anything else? We're done? Prabhupada ki jai.